Passing Parade, your favorite stories as told by your favorite storyteller, a man whose voice is familiar to millions of theatergoers and radio listeners. Here's John Nesbitt to bring you some stories from The Passing Parade.
An ancient unwritten law of the sea holds that if a ship strikes disaster, the captain is always to blame. This is a heartbreaking rule in many cases, and it smashed the careers and lives of thousands of brave and innocent men. An accident at sea. And unless the explanation offers overwhelming evidence on the other side, the skipper is washed out. He's beached for life. The iron-hard court-martials of the Navy are based upon this principle. That come storm or hurricane, tidal wave, or fire or iceberg, the captain is to blame. He can erase the accusations best in one way. To grip like a vice on the quarterdeck rail and go down with his sinking ship. And behind this ruthless tradition, there lies some terrible memories. The Morro Castle disaster is an example of recent times. No seagoing vessel was ever made that was any better or safer than the men who sailed her. The Morro Castle met death in the morning of September the 8th in 1934. 137 people were drowned or burned alive. Yet the Morro Castle was an honestly built ship. She was one of the world's most up-to-date vessels. She was appointed like a floating Waldorf Astoria. She had a fortune's worth of automatic devices to put out fires. She was carefully inspected and carefully operated. She had 318 passengers and a full crew of 240. If you like being superstitious about the sea, you have evidence here to imagine that what struck the Morro Castle was a mysterious jinx and not merely the shortcomings of men. For in September of 1933, the castle was caught in a hurricane off Cape Hatteras and all but turned turtle. And 2 months later, her ill fortune led her to be cruising off Cuba just at the time that a revolution burst out. And she was caught in the crossfire between gunboats and a shore battery and scarred with explosive shells. No sooner had her owners made repairs for these two events when under mysterious circumstances her cargo twice caught fire. In both cases, they were promptly put out. But they were one reason why, on the night of September the 7th in 1934, she had some of the most modern fire detection systems in existence. During the captain's dinner party that evening, Captain Wilmot suddenly fell ill and fainted. Taken to his cabin, he sank deeper into a coma. And as the orchestra began playing foxtrots for the main dance of the cruise, word was brought to the passengers that Captain Wilmot was dead. One of the neatly uniformed, ordinary seamen on deck now remarked again that the Jinx was still sailing, and it was no good for the Morro Castle to dock always at Pier 13 when she reached home port. And there was real sorrow as well as shock among the passengers when the death of Captain Wilmot was announced, for he was a friendly and easygoing man. Yet, as he was a sailor, it is more than possible that Wilmot would have thanked death for sparing him the next 20 hours that he might have lived through. It was quite foggy that night with a choppy sea. And inside the public rooms of the handsome vacation cruiser, however, the decorations were still in place. Dozens of balloons floating against the ceiling, bright streamers crisscrossed from the lighting fixtures. Although most of the passengers, honeymooners in brand new clothes, or office workers who'd saved for years for this cruise, were avid for a good time, they put on a respectable solemnity in the presence of the death of the captain. By the hour of 2 in the morning, virtually all the revelers had gone silently to bed. Some of them stayed up a few more minutes to pack their bags, for the Morro Castle docked promptly at noon next day in New York. At 42 minutes after 2 a.m., a crew member on the night watch ran across the deck and climbed up to the captain's bridge. Up there, behind plate glass, snug and calm as he puffed his pipe and peered out into the fog, was First Officer William Worms. The instant the captain had drawn his last breath, it was William Worms who became the man to blame. The man whose life was tied up with the life of this ship. The able-bodied seaman from below hauled himself up and half out of breath, he said, "Smoke and sparks coming in from a port ventilator amidship, sir." First Officer Worms took it calmly, as was his duty, and quietly turned to the second in command, Officer Hackley. "Investigate it at once, please." Officer Hackley disappeared down the ladder right after the seaman. Below, he discovered the cause of the sparks. A fire was blazing in the dainty little writing room, decorated for passengers by a leading furniture firm in New York. The elaborate fire alarm system hadn't been installed in these public rooms, where fire at sea virtually never originates. The paneling of the walls was blistered by the heat, and the draperies were flaring up brightly. That was the little fire that killed the Morro Castle, and tortured 137 humans to their deaths as well. What follows aboard this doomed luxury vessel is the ancient story of unbelievable human error, unbelievable heroism, and it adds another cause for the tradition that so seldom forgives the master of the ship for a single error.
That's the first half of John Nesbitt's story on today's Passing Parade. While he's preparing his notes for the second portion, let's listen to some music from Victor Young. Again is John Nesbitt to continue his story on The Passing Parade.
On the reviewing stand once more, when from the bridge of the Morro Castle the first alarm went out at about 2:47 a.m., fire all watches on deck, the crew came on the run. The crew came with such haste that not a man stopped as they shot past sets of heavy open doors of steel. Those doors were fire doors carefully designed to divide the ship into flame-tight compartments, but they were not closed. But with all this speed, the men were already too late. For in the fancy little writing room, the flames had eaten through the painted ceiling. There was an airspace between this ceiling and the steel deck above. The deck should have stopped the flames, and perhaps not a passenger would ever have learned of the trouble. But alas for them, one of the prides of the Morro Castle was its air conditioning. It had been designed to keep passengers cool in the tropics. So a multitude of air shafts and ventilators ran like great blood vessels through the mass of the ship. And through these tubes, the heat and flame began to race, as if blown by a hurricane. At 56 minutes past two, rigid now, First Officer Worms jerked the levers that would send the alarm shrieking through the ship. He did so just 14 minutes after that worried seaman had poked his head above the bridge. The passengers awoke and slid to their feet and opened their cabin doors. The corridors were already furnaces. They were giant-sized tubes drawing that gale of flame through the ship. And the rest of the story can only be told in flashes of fire, in searing glimpses remembered afterward by those who lived through the night. There were 12 good lifeboats available. 8 of them were finally launched. But out of 318 passengers, only 85 reached safety. It requires a superbly trained crew and constantly drilled passengers to make full use of all the lifeboats in a panic. And this was a pleasure cruiser. The drills were not adequate. As each of these lessons came home, dozens of people died, as they always have, when a trifling carelessness turns into catastrophe. Crouched over his radio equipment, Chief Radio Operator George W. Rogers did his duty. and that duty was to wait for captain's orders before sending out the SOS. Here's another tradition of the sea, clad in iron. The captain must, in his judgment, delay the SOS for as long as is reasonable. For even if he overcomes the trouble, once the SOS is out, half the value of the ship and cargo goes to the first rescue vessel to arrive. And the first officer waited too long. For 20 minutes, Rogers agonized there in the radio room, with his fingers on the key, and no order came. Twice, Rogers sent his assistant operator to the captain for orders. No orders were given. At 3:15 a.m., Rogers sent the CQ, the clear-the-air signal, and he did so on his own responsibility. And when at 3:24 the order at last came from the captain, Rogers was holding a wet towel to his face, his equipment scorched and aflame. With an emergency transmitter, he sent out the three letters SOS. They circled out through the fog-bound sky just once. Morro Castle, a fire, 20 miles south of Scotland Light. S-O-S. At 29 minutes past 3, the lighting plant failed, darkness fell, and chaos turned itself loose. Human beings were seen in the flashes of flame crawling by on all fours. Others were huddled without moving, praying quietly. At 4 a.m., a 26-foot motorboat manned by 5 Coast Guardsmen roared toward the burning ship. Out of the water came hands and arms clutching at the hull. In 5 minutes, the little powerboat was in danger of foundering, and her skipper was obliged to reverse his engines and pull away from the other arms stretched up from the water. He made for a Luckenbach liner 2.5 miles away, unloaded his half-conscious passengers, and roared back to the funeral fire that was once the Morro Castle. The 5 boys of the Coast Guard in their tiny craft saved 112 lives that night. Dawn broke out on the New Jersey shore in the morning, and along the beaches, men and women from the Morro Castle, who happened to be good swimmers, dragged themselves up on the sand and collapsed, gasping out thanks to God. Other human forms reached the beach that morning, but they were corpses carried in on the tide. Empty lifeboats, bright patent leather suitcases, fine tennis rackets, and dozens of curios and souvenirs that had been purchased during the wonderful vacation to the south. The beach was littered with all of these things. When the corpse of the Morro Castle herself was towed into the Asbury Park Pier, with First Officer Worms and 13 of his crew staying with her, as was their final obligation, a kind of shameful thing took place. 350,000 people came to the beach and pier to watch and look at the smoking ruin. The concessions opened especially for the occasion, even though it was winter, and did $500,000 worth of business. As such men must in this profession, First Officer Worms and the Chief Engineer stood investigation and trial. They were sentenced to prison for incompetence. 3 years later, they were released when it was satisfactorily proved that the long dead captain had been too friendly and too easy a man. He had failed to maintain the unending discipline which might have tuned his officers to a point where they would not have failed in disaster. Congress launched an investigation, and today there are sprinkling systems in every quarter of our American ships and dozens of other invisible safeguards, all stemming from that investigation. And for each one of these new devices, men and women died at sea on the night of September 7th and 8th in 1934, when a good ship sailed into the inferno.
You have been listening to Your Favorite Stories as told by America's favorite storyteller, John Nesbitt. Be with us the next time we move to the reviewing stand for yet another glimpse of The Passing Parade. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.